It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember. I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here! Tonight, let us make them remember. We are not afraid!
Yeah, we're not afraid of the truth. Can I have some truth? Give me some truth, justice, and what used to be the American way. You know, put a big giant, S on somebody's chest and go out and be somebody. Let's go defend something. What are we going to defend? How about individual rights? And who's going to have that on their chest? How about Super Captain America? Yeah, let's do that. Well, one of these guys, big guy, WWE wrestler Kane, Glenn Jacobs, otherwise known as Citizen X, did a podcast here recently, and I wanted to get into that. And I think you will find it extremely informative. Let's go ahead and just start.
Okay. Anyway, a friend of mine collects old carnival games. One day he was showing me a new game that he recently purchased. It was sort of like basketball, except played with baseballs. You had three tries to bounce a baseball off of a backboard and into the basket beneath. My buddy showed me how it was done. He would say that you have to hit right here on the backboard, wrapping the backboard with his fist for emphasis. Then he would back up and toss the baseball off the backboard, rebounding it into the basket below. I'd then try my three throws, and no matter how I threw the baseball, I couldn't get it to drop through the basket. He'd say, "It was easy. You just got to hit right here, once again wrapping the backboard in the appropriate spot," and then he'd toss the ball off the backboard, and it would fall into the basket below. So this goes on and on. We must have played for like 15 minutes. I knew the game was fixed, but I kept on playing anyway, thinking that I could adjust my throws or just get lucky. I knew that if I just tried harder or played smarter, I would eventually win. Well, you know how this turns out. I never won. Finally, my buddy showed me how the game was fixed. Behind the backboard was a false panel. Inside the panel was a board that sat on a fulcrum, a lever. When my buddy hit the backboard with his fist, the top of the board fell backwards away from the backboard, making the backboard much more dead so the ball would not rebound as hard. When the baseball fell through the basket and into the pit at the bottom of the game, it would push the bottom of the board backwards, causing the top part of the board to lean forward against the backboard, greatly increasing the rebound of the backboard. No matter how well I threw the ball, it was virtually impossible to win the game. Doesn't this sound suspiciously like electoral politics? I mean, how many folks are out there thinking that if they just try harder, if they just get the right folks elected, they can win the political game? I get it on my blog, adventuresofcitizenx.com, all the time. I see comments like, "The only tool that I need is my vote." And sure, Scott Brown, the Republican who recently won the U.S. Massachusetts Senate seat, isn't the perfect conservative, but he'll be the 41st vote against Obamacare, and if he is the most liberal Republican in the Senate, we'll be headed down the right path to taking this country back. Politics is a rigged game. We all know that, especially you, the conspirators. However, what is the lever that keeps people in the game? What is the mechanism that allows folks to think that they can win the game? What is it that convinces very intelligent, passionate people that electoral politics can make a difference, but is actually a tool to facilitate the growth of government? That lever, that mechanism, is the United States Constitution. Now, for many people, this statement borders on heresy, especially for folks who may be new to these podcasts. The Constitution is the sacred cow of American politics. You can question Congress. You can question the president. You can question the Supreme Court justices. But you cannot question the document which created these positions and empowered these people. You cannot question the Constitution. In other words, you can question the players, but you are not allowed to question the rules of the game. That's a mistake. Whether you agree with the evidence that I'm going to present here, that the Constitution is not only an enabler of big government, but that it was designed to foster the growth of government, I think it's important that you ask these questions and consider this possibility. Perhaps I'm wrong, and if you come to that conclusion, fine. But please give what I'm about to say, the evidence and the implications of that evidence, a fair hearing. Even if you don't agree with my conclusions, the consideration of different perspectives is always beneficial. And perhaps contemplating a different historical context than the one which we are generally taught, as well as historical facts which are not readily available, indeed, which for the most part have gone down the memory hole, will lead to a better understanding of the Constitution, the ideas behind it, and its limitations and weaknesses for those of us who believe in individual liberty. For much of this podcast, I rely on Kenneth W. Royce's book, Hologram of Liberty, The Constitution's Shocking Alliance with Big Government. Kenneth is also known by his pseudonym, Boston Tea Party. I had the pleasure of meeting Boston at last year's Liberty Forum. His book, Boston's Gun Bible, may be the best book ever written about guns. And for that reason, Boston is unfairly characterized as a gun guy. But he's an extremely sharp gentleman with a well-rounded knowledge of politics, history, and law. I would also encourage anyone who hasn't read No Treason, The Constitution of No Authority by Lysander Spooner, the eminent 19th century libertarian, activist, and abolitionist, to do so. It's a short little pamphlet which is available online for free and asks some inconvenient questions about the Constitution. One of my favorite Spooner quotes is, "Our constitutions," and by this he is referring to the federal and state constitutions, "our constitutions purport to be established by the people. And in theory, all the people consent to such government as the constitutions authorize. But this consent of the people exists only in theory. It has no existence in fact. Government is in reality established by the few. And these few assume the consent of all the rest without any such consent being actually given." Keep that in mind the next time you hear some blowhard politician spewing platitudes about the will of the people. There's a fact which is beyond dispute. The Constitution has not stopped the growth of government in America. As Spooner said, "But whether the Constitution really be one thing or another, this much is certain, that it has either authorized such a government as we have had, or has been powerless to prevent it. In either case, it is unfit to exist." So which is it? Did the Constitution authorize such a government as Leviathan under which we now suffer? Or is this monstrosity the result of power-mongering politicians and bureaucrats taking advantage of inadvertent mistakes in the structure and language of the Constitution? I used to tell people that if government would abide by the Constitution, I would not be where I am philosophically. Then one day a libertarian lawyer friend of mine, yes, they do exist, facetiously replied, "Who the hell are you to interpret the Constitution? You're not a lawyer. You never even went to law school. You are not qualified to offer an opinion on the meaning of the Constitution." And there you have it. Much of the liberty movement is aimed at getting back to the Constitution and restoring the Republic. Well, folks, we're operating under a constitutional system. To my knowledge, the Constitution and the Bill of Rights have never been suspended. The government as it stands now is perfectly legitimate from a constitutional perspective. In other words, there is no restoring the Republic because there is nothing constitutionally wrong with the Republic. Now you might say, but the Constitution says, and I would probably agree with you. The problem is that unless you're a lawyer with a penchant for black dresses and no moral qualms about forcing other individuals to call you your honor, you are not qualified to make that statement.
You're not qualified. You're just not qualified. Well, we'll hear some more when we come back.
There are those that just want to be left alone, and those that just won't leave them alone. Which one are you? The Ernest Hancock Show.
You're most likely right, but legally, it doesn't matter. Everything the government has done, every liberty that it has taken, every liberty that it has taken from us, every activity in which it engages is constitutional. Why? Because the Supreme Court is the ultimate arbitrator of all things constitutional. And if the Supreme Court says it's okay, it's okay. So much for that vaunted checks and balances thing. What sort of contract gives one party to the contract the monopoly right on the interpretation and enforcement of that contract? You might say, that was a mistake. The Supreme Court overstepped its bounds way back in 1803 in Marbury versus Madison, in which it unilaterally arrogated the right of judicial review, that is, the right to decide if an act of Congress is constitutional, making the Supreme Court the ultimate authority on both the letter and spirit of the Constitution. But was it a mistake? Was it really? Why is it that out of 300 million people in this country, it is only the opinion of 9 lawyers that really matters? Now, some historical perspective is needed at this point. The mainstream narrative of the early political history of the U.S. is that a group of great American patriots threw off the chains of the tyrannical government, establishing a new confederation in America under the Articles of Confederation. However, this new form of government was too weak and threatened the freedom and stability of the nascent alliance. Thus, representatives from the various states met in Philadelphia to amend the Articles of Confederation. They decided that the problems of the Confederation were too big and that a more powerful central government was needed. So they rejected their mandate and wrote a document which would create such a central government, taking great care to ensure that this government would be kept in check and never become tyrannical. This document, the U.S. Constitution, would be considered the apex of classical liberal political thought. The American people, seeing their wisdom and tired of suffering under an inefficient system of government, applauded these efforts, and with the exception of a few stubborn individuals, supported the new Constitution and the government it created. And we all lived happily ever after. Not so much. Here are some little-known facts about the post-revolutionary period. First, the Founding Fathers were not a homogeneous group who believed in a single political theory. By and large, they can be divided into two groups. The radicals, folks like Samuel Adams, Thomas Paine, Patrick Henry, Richard Henry Lee, who incidentally was the great-uncle of Confederate General Robert E. Lee, and Thomas Jefferson. The radicals opposed big government on principle. On the other hand, there were the nationalists, led by George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, and Alexander Hamilton. While the nationalists may have held some of the same views as the radicals, their main problem was not with government, but with the British government. They wanted to implement an American system based on British mercantilism, just without the British. From 1781 until 1787, the various state governments were allied together in a loose confederation with a weak central government formed by the Articles of Confederation. It is important to remember that America in this incarnation was able to defeat the most powerful military in the world, the British Empire, with, of course, some help from the French. So the idea that the Articles provided too weak a national defense is absolutely laughable. But that was one of the arguments against the Articles, that its weak central government imperiled the physical safety of the Confederation. The real problem with the Articles was that the nationalists could not assume enough control using the central government as their vehicle, since Congress relied on the goodwill of the states to fund it. This situation was intolerable to the nationalists. George Washington, for example, wrote to John Jay in 1786, "We probably had too good an opinion of human nature in forming our Confederation. Experience has taught us that men will not adopt and carry into execution measures the best circulated for their own good, without the intervention of a coercive power. Many are of the opinion that Congress have too frequently made use of the suppliant, humble tome of requisition and applications to the states, when they had a right to assert their imperial dignity and command obedience. If you tell the state legislators they have invaded the prerogatives of the Confederacy, they will laugh in your face." Imperial dignity, command obedience, coercive power. Translation: we need to be able to force people to do what we want them to do, and the states are standing in our way. You see, the difference between a federal government and a national government is that in a federal system, the central government has no direct power over the citizens of the states, since the states retain their sovereignty and make their own laws. In the national system, on the other hand, the states are simply departments of the central government, negating the state's ability to interpose themselves between the central government and their citizens, and placing the citizens under direct control of the national government. Hence, the term Federalist, when applied to the Nationalists, as in the Federalist Papers, was a misnomer. The real Federalists were the Anti-Federalists. But just like Socialists hijacked the term Liberal from the classical Liberals, the Nationalists hijacked the term Federalist from the real Federalists and burdened the actual Federalist with the negative-sounding Anti-Federalist, securing a rhetorical victory and immediately putting the Antis on the defensive and confusing people to this date, including myself. In August of 1786, a Revolutionary War captain named Daniel Shays led 1,100 men, angered by Massachusetts raising taxes to pay its war debt, in an attack on the Springfield Courthouse and Federal Arsenal. Although Shays' rebellion was short-lived and a military failure, it had enormous political consequences. John Hancock easily defeated the incumbent governor, and three-quarters of the Massachusetts House were thrown out. Debt relief laws were enacted, and taxes were significantly lowered. Much like the American Revolution, the rabble was on the rise. Much like their British masters before them, the American nationalists would have none of it. In Democracy for a Few, Michael Perini writes, most troubling to the framers of the Constitution was the increasing insurgent spirit evidenced among the people. Fearing the popular takeover of state governments, the wealthy class looked to a national government as a means of protecting their interests. Thomas Jefferson said about Shays' rebellion, "Our convention has been too much impressed by the insurrection in Massachusetts. And in the spur of the moment, they are setting up a kite to keep the henyard in order." In May of 1787, the Nationalists made their move. Incessant propaganda about the imperfections of the Articles of Confederation led to the Philadelphia Convention. Sent by the states to revise the Articles, the delegates of the Philadelphia Convention launched nothing less than a coup d'etat, scrapping the Articles and proposing an entirely different form of government. The Philadelphia Convention was subject to unprecedented security. It was held on the second floor with the windows shut, sentries posted below, and the delegates sworn to secrecy. The convention's journal was not published until 32 years later. And James Madison's notes, the best chronicle of the convention's proceedings, were not published until 53 years afterwards. We've all heard the apocryphal story about the woman asking Benjamin Franklin when he emerged from the convention, "Sir, what have you given us?" Based on all this secrecy, I bet what she really would have said was, "Sir, what have you given us?" Or perhaps...
"Or what have you done to us?" Yeah, we'll get right back into it when we come back. You know, this is interesting stuff. This is stuff that a whole new generation of young people have not been indoctrinated like a lot of others. They're asking questions, and they're learning and getting answers.
And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
What have you done to us? I went to the Libertarian Party National Convention in 2008. When you go to one of these things, you get a feel for what's going on. You can just watch people and sort of know what they're up to, or know at least that they're up to something. Unless you're there, you never quite get the full story of what's going on. While Thomas Jefferson was generally supportive of the Constitution, since he was in France during the convention, he would have been unaware of the political machinations, backroom deals, and intrigues that went on at the convention. I wonder what he would have said if he'd been there. Perhaps that's another reason that the convention was held when it was, to mute the voice of the most respected radical. But it wasn't just Jefferson who was neutralized. The Philadelphia Convention was made up of folks much different than the famous radicals who launched the American Revolution. Only 8 of the 55 delegates had signed the Declaration of Independence, and only 6 of them had signed the Articles of Confederation. Samuel Adams, the leader of the Boston Tea Party, Samuel Adams was not chosen as a delegate. Neither was Thomas Paine, the author of the spark that started the revolution, Common Sense. Patrick Henry, remember, "Give me liberty or give me death," Patrick Henry? He refused to attend the convention because, I quote, he smelt a rat. During the Virginia Ratification Convention, Henry spoke before the assembly for hours, lambasting the proposed Constitution. No, this wasn't the same group of radicals that threw off British rule. Of the 55 delegates at Philadelphia, 21 favored some sort of monarchy. 21 favored a monarchy. 41 were politicians. And here's the key stat. If you don't remember anything else from this podcast, remember this. Of the 55 delegates at the Philadelphia Convention, 34 were lawyers. You see, the Constitution was written by lawyers, not by apolitical demigods who were transcribing sacred text, but by lawyers. Now, why is the fact that the Constitution was written by lawyers so important? Well, it destroys the notion that the Constitution's ambiguities and general language were unfortunate accidents. Lawyers do not use ambiguous language. They do not engage in writing that is open to interpretation. Would any lawyer worth his salt write a contract that was not as airtight as possible, that could be interpreted in more than one way, that was not clear and precise? Of course not. On the other hand, when examining contracts written by others, lawyers are like locksmiths. They look for any weakness, any little loophole that they can exploit. The framers had to have known that big government statists would try to do the very same thing, exploit any loophole that they could with this document that they had created. And this is exactly what has happened. So how do we explain this? It's because the framers were the big government statists. They deliberately created a document that could be exploited. Their challenge was that they could not be overt. They had to convince enough folks that the Constitution was not a threat to their liberty and then they could begin the incremental process of expanding the loopholes that they had deliberately created. Thus, the haste with which the Constitution was sent to the states for ratification. The fact that only 9 states had to ratify the Constitution for it to take effect. The marvelous propaganda campaign highlighted by the Federalist Papers. The smearing of anyone standing in their way, and the political bribes, including federal assumption of state debts. After the Constitution was ratified, Washington got his wish. The national government was able to assert its imperial dignity and command obedience from the states. Rhode Island was the last holdout for joining the Union. Rhodes Island, as it was called, had refused to send delegates to the Philadelphia Convention. Instead of the Constitution being ratified by the State Assembly, Rhode Island held a referendum where the people voted. Ratification was voted down by a margin of 11-1. Instead of letting Rhode Island go her way in peace, on 18 May 1790, the U.S. Senate voted to embargo all trade between the 12 United States and Little Rhode Island. Of course, this action was taken under powers granted by, yeah, you guessed it, the Interstate Commerce Clause. An embargo, by the way, is an act of war. In any case, Rhode Island reluctantly ratified the Constitution 2 weeks later, and the Union was complete. As Boston Tea Party notes, if Rhode Island, a sovereign nation completely outside the jurisdiction of the federal government, can be so overtly bullied in 1790, then how much more vulnerable today are the 50 states, or the people, or mere individuals? Now, before I move on, I'd like to address one more historic myth. One of the reasons given for the establishment of a strong central government was that under the Articles of Confederation, the states were raising trade barriers against one another. According to Jeffrey Rogers Hummel, that is simply not so. This idea arises from the fact that the states were competing for foreign trade and sometimes taxed foreign goods that were imported from another state. By and large, however, Hummel says that the general rule was full reciprocity between the states when it came to trade. If anything, the nationalists believed that tariffs were too low. Remember, like Henry Clay after them, the nationalists wanted to implement an American system, which would consist of a system of internal improvements, a central bank, and high tariffs. In Federalist No. 12, Alexander Hamilton advocates tripling the existing tariffs. Hitherto, I believe, it may safely be asserted that these duties have not, upon an average, exceeded in any state 3%. In France, they are estimated to be about 15%, and in Britain, they exceed this proportion. There seems to be nothing to hinder their being increased in this country to at least treble their present amount. The single article of ardent spirits under federal regulation might be made to furnish a considerable revenue. Of course, it's all about money. Besides, even if it were true that trade wars between the states led to the creation of a strong central government, the Constitution failed to alleviate this problem. After all, part of the cause of the war between the states was tariffs which protected northern manufacturers from foreign competition, but punished southern consumers of finished goods with higher prices and injured the relations between southern exporters of raw materials and their foreign trading partners. So enough with the history. Is the Constitution a document that promotes individual liberty or not? Well, let's compare it to what many consider to be its sister document, the Declaration of Independence. The Declaration states that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Unalienable means that rights are absolute, they're unassailable, they cannot be violated. They cannot, as Guard often says, be attenuated. It's too bad that the Constitution doesn't take the same attitude towards natural rights. Although the Bill of Rights was added to the Constitution over the objections of the Nationalists, it does not go nearly far enough in the protection of individual liberties. For example, while Jefferson makes it clear that the right to property, the pursuit of happiness, is sacrosanct and absolute, the Fifth Amendment makes it clear that the government can take property at its whim. The Takings Clause reads, "Nor shall private property be taken for public use," and I almost said public purpose because that's how the Supreme Court now reads this clause, "without just compensation." Who determines just compensation? Why, the government does. Why not just say, "Nor shall private property be taken," and leave it at that? The First Amendment only prohibits Congress from establishing a state religion. It doesn't say anything about infringing upon religious freedom. And although you do have the right to petition the government to redress your grievances, according to the Supreme Court, the government doesn't actually have to answer your questions. A lot of the good that does. Just ask Bob Schultz and the We the People Foundation. Then you've got the Second Amendment, in which a comma has been the subject of years of controversy.
Yeah, no, I got to plug it in. Yeah, that's a good place to stop it right there. We'll go ahead and get into it. You know, you had the Second Amendment. They're talking about, you know, they put a comma in there, you know, the regulate a well-regulated militia. Now, one thing I want to bring up that a lot of people don't ever bring up, a well-regulated militia meant well-sighted in, you know, well-trained. You remember Young Guns, they go, "Mount up, regulators." You know, it was an old Western term. You know, they had was it Billy the Kid or something? Well, that's what they were talking about. Regulated, not controlled or licensed. That's not what they meant.
And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
Well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. Why a free state? The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Why not simply say, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed? Yeah, I realize that preambles explaining the reasoning behind a particular concept were the style of the day in political writing during this period. But still, why was it necessary to include the word state in this particular amendment? Especially when the Bill of Rights was concerned with the rights of individuals and not of the states or the state. After all, the Fourth Amendment begins with the right of the people. And speaking of the Fourth Amendment, it protects us from unreasonable searches and seizures. But who determines what's unreasonable? Well, of course, the government does. How convenient. But all of this pales in comparison to what I consider to be the biggie, the most important protection of individuals from government tyranny, the Great Writ established in 1215 at Runnymede, England, habeas corpus. The prohibition on government disappearing people, on black vans pulling up, snatching you off the street or out of your home and holding you incognito, persona non grata, without trial or charges against you. The Constitution is strangely silent on this subject, except to grant Congress the right to suspend habeas corpus. Remember when we all made fun of Alberto Gonzalez for stating that the Constitution did not grant a right to habeas corpus? His argument was illogical to constitutionalists. Of course we have a right to habeas corpus. The problem is that Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution states, "The privilege of the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended unless when in cases of rebellion or invasion the public safety may require it." You see, technically, Gonzalez was correct. There is no right, only a privilege. Rights are inherent. Privileges are granted. You have no right to habeas corpus according to the U.S. Constitution. But at least the Constitution does prohibit Congress from suspending habeas corpus unless it thinks it needs to. So who does the Constitution really protect? You or the government? While Jefferson wrote that whenever a form of government becomes destructive of these ends, that is, the protection of natural rights, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it. The Constitution says that when people invoke this right, they can be thrown into a jail cell for the rest of their lives or summarily executed without charges, without counsel, without recourse. Some protection, huh? The Interstate Commerce Clause, the General Welfare Clause, the Necessary and Proper Clause were all designed to allow government to expand, for Congress to take on more and more powers. But what about the system of checks and balances? As I've already stated, all three branches of government are branches of the same government. There are no checks and balances. But what about impeachments? Why do you think the power to try impeachments resides in the Senate and not in the House? It's because the Senate is much more further removed from the people than the House is. And unlike congressmen, who are up for election every 2 years, senators are up for election every 6 years. Do you think that was an accident? And by the way, how many impeachments of government officials do you remember anyway? According to Boston Tea Party, there's been like 9 since 1940. Why were Americans not given the ability to recall their representatives or to vote no confidence in the government? Wouldn't that be a much better method of impeachment? Well, of course it would. But that would have threatened the people who were expecting to be running the new government, the Constitution's framers. Even worse is the federal government's power to enter into treaties that carry the force of law and are considered, like the Constitution, the supreme law of the land. All that has to happen is the president signs a treaty and 2/3 of the Congress ratify the treaty. But here's the kicker. Only 2/3 of the senators present are needed to ratify. Let me repeat that. Only 2/3 of the senators present are needed to ratify a treaty. In 1952, with 2 senators on the floor, the Senate ratified 3 treaties. And one of the senators didn't even vote. That means that one guy ratified 3 treaties. Now, of course, this led to some outrage, and now the Senate rules state that the ratifications must be preceded by a quorum call. But remember, the Senate, like the House, is allowed to make its own rules under the Constitution, and this practice is voluntary and not mandated by the Constitution. Finally, there is the Supreme Court. In Federalist Number 78, Hamilton says that the judicial branch was the weakest and the least dangerous branch of the federal government. As usual, Hamilton was, to be generous, being a little disingenuous. At least the executive and legislative branches are somewhat answerable to the people. The justices of the Supreme Court, however, are political appointees who hold their positions for life. The Constitution does not say a whole lot about the judicial branch. The number of justices in the Supreme Court is not specified, and Congress is given the power to create any system of federal courts that it sees fit. In April 1789, a Senate committee was appointed to create this federal judicial system. Of the 7 members, 4 were Philadelphia Convention delegates and lawyers. According to Boston Tea Party, the bill that they drafted, which was nearly twice as long as the Constitution itself, was really an amendment to the Constitution, not a simple piece of legislation. However, since the Nationalists knew that it would never be ratified by the states, Washington hastily signed it into law, and the national dialogue shifted to the ratification of the still-pending Bill of Rights. All of this was no accident. It was done by design. In September of 1787, Alexander Hamilton, commenting on the potential of the loophole known as the Necessary and Proper Clause, wrote, "The proposed national government may then triumph altogether over the state governments and reduce them to an entire subordination, dividing the larger states into smaller districts. The organs of the general government may also acquire additional strength." Don't think that Hamilton knew what he was doing. Hamilton's only lament was that the Constitution did not go far enough and was frail and worthless fabric.
Now, there's lots more that we could talk about, and Boston Tea Party does in Hologram of Liberty. But suffice it to say that the Constitution is no friend of liberty. Now, that's not to say that the Constitution is completely useless in moving towards a freer society. It's a great pedagogical tool, at least introducing the concept that government should be limited, even if it hasn't quite turned out that way. It's also a tremendous rhetorical weapon. I find it ironic that people who question the Constitution, folks like myself and Guard and Boston Tea Party, probably have more respect for the document and hold it in higher esteem than the people who actually take an oath to support it. I personally will support a guy like Ron Paul who takes a strict constructionist view of the Constitution because I believe that that will lead to a freer society than the one which we now have. However, I differ with constitutionalists, and I believe that this is a good place to start, not that a restoration of the Republic should be our end goal. And even this is dangerous, since the machinery of tyranny has not been dismantled, but simply diminished. And you see, leftists aren't the only ones who promote an expansive reading of the Constitution when it suits their purposes. Guard tells the story of talking with Tom Tancredo and pointing out that immigration, according to the Constitution, is not a federal issue. Tancredo agreed, but said, "Yeah, but we've got to do something about immigration." I saw the other day where Michelle Melkin was saying that conservatives already have a guide, the Constitution. I wonder where in the Constitution the federal government is given the power to throw Muslims, or anyone else for that matter, into internment camps, or where it says that the president can unilaterally declare war, or where it says that abortion is a federal issue, especially since the Constitution only places three crimes under federal purview: counterfeiting, except of course when the Fed does it, piracy, and treason. But I think the most pernicious aspect of the Constitution is the fact that it legitimizes government. A few episodes back, Guard talked about the Jeffersonian concept of a just government in the Declaration of Independence. There is nothing just about something which is predicated on coercion. Now, of course, there are much more unjust governments than others, and I thank my lucky stars that I live here in America and not in North Korea. But the fact remains that government cannot be truly just. The Constitution promotes the myth that government can be just, that it can be legitimate, as long, of course, as it's constitutional. How much time, energy, effort, and lives have been devoted to perpetuating this myth? How many personal tragedies have resulted from this myth? I first recorded this podcast last Thursday.
You know, this is what he goes on to say is that he recorded the podcast on the same day that Joe Stack flew his plane into the Austin IRS building. And he wanted to, you know, we'll just hold off a couple of days and he'll have something to say about it. And it's almost done. You got probably, there's another 10 minutes to this. I'll put the link up on Freedom's Phoenix on today's archive so you could hear the last 10 minutes if you want. But this, good information that a lot of us, when you hear the things I talk about, there's a lot of people studying for 20 years or so, we knew this. And I wanted to make sure that you did. The Hologram of Liberty. Boston Tea Party. You might want to order it. See you tomorrow.